Want to have your say? Ring Jared on 1300 736 736. Now, back to Waitley.
It is World Test Championship Week, Wednesday night from the Oval, right here on SEN Test Cricket, Australia and India. And a little Ashes heart starter with the Baz Ballers making a mess of Ireland with some record-breaking run-scoring spree on Friday night, which was something to behold. The stakes are high, even higher, I think, after Dave Warner's expressed desire to see a farewell Test match in Sydney come January, against a backdrop of what is a nationwide debate whether he should even be there at Edgbaston at the start of this Ashes run. It ratchets up the stakes in what is a pretty tense time. If selectors drop him now, it looks like they're ending one of the all-time careers. The coach, Andrew McDonald, in this studio a week ago, was as unequivocal of Warner's credentials as anyone in the Australian setup had been. He guaranteed him the first two Test matches, and then what happens beyond. Here was the coach after Warner had expressed his heart's desire that, all going well, he'll be there in Sydney come January.
Oh, I think it's great that he's planning on playing a lot longer. So, and as you said, I mean, the discussion around any player will always come down to form and how they fit, how the team's functioning. And what we're seeing from Dave here in terms of his preparation's been, you know, high level again. He's ready for the contest. And I suppose that speaks volumes around that comment that, you know, he's looking forward and believes he can still impact this team. And you wouldn't want a player thinking anything else, would you? So Sydney's obviously a long way off. What's in front of us at the moment is the World Test Championship final, and no doubt that Dave's thought about how, you know, all three formats work and potentially what the future holds for him. But come the 7th, I think he'll be pretty zeroed in on whatever that contest looks with the new ball.
His long-term place has been honoured at the top of the order in the World Test Championship. Beyond that, well, I just think he would want to make runs. He would want to make runs in England. So we're going to rely on the wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock, especially over the next 6 or 7 weeks. Crash, what an exciting time we're about to launch into.
Yeah, look, I love your little prequel there, Jared. It was lovely to get to this week. And you know, just the World Test Championship. A lot of people still struggle to get their heads around what it actually is. But I think it's growing, and I like what it's doing for Test cricket. A lot of talk about eligibility for it, who's going to get there, who won't. You know, it's bigger than it was a couple of years ago when New Zealand won it. So it does mean a lot. But yeah, Warner's declaration he's playing on, it really has spiced up the plot, hasn't it? Or he wants to play on, shall I correct myself?
So I defer to your wisdom and experience in these moments, Crash. But if you ever wanted to understand the selfish nature of cricket, I think this is it. It's an individual sport played in a team environment. Warner had the chance to call his own timeline if he'd gone out in the SCG test in January off the back of his double century. I think this inflames the debate that the selectors are having at the moment with a magnitude that sits over it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But look, Jared, he's not the first person to set a long-term goal and strive to get it as a batsman and perhaps fall short if he does. Doug Walters retired after not getting a farewell tour of England. Ian Healy, remember, wanted one last test at the Gabba before the selectors replaced him with Adam Gilchrist. He didn't get it. David Byrne wanted a farewell test, farewell Ashes series. He was working towards it and he just fell short. But it certainly has intensified the debate over Warner's future. I don't think his statement greatly changes the narrative. And I'll tell you why. Because if he's in form in this Ashes series, he will progress effortlessly to the Pakistan series, which is 3 tests in Australia, and then he would quit on his home ground. If he fails in the Ashes, the selectors are not going to protect him, protect his long-term goal. You know, that they will move on. The only area, Jared, where I think it will tell, and that is simply this. If he gets to the Pakistan series in Australia next summer, they will not drop him during it. That wouldn't happen. He wouldn't fall one test short of getting to Sydney in his final test. I mean, I just reckon they'd give him that, you know, particularly if they win. But it certainly came out of the blue, I have to say.
Yes, and it was sort of an extension on what he had given himself before, which was the 50-over World Cup. Anyway, I think, I know not, and it's just my view, I do think this has the capacity to unsettle the entire Australian camp. If he doesn't make runs early, I think this becomes a major issue that they will have to grapple with and deal with.
Yeah, I don't believe his pledge becomes a major issue. I don't, because that's just a player setting a long-term goal. He'd like to get to it. But I do think the two most singularly important selection issues on this tour, by a substantial margin, are Warner's future and Josh Hazlewood, who was ruled out of the Test Championship. He bowled brilliantly, apparently, in the nets with enormous gusto, but then maybe he just felt something wasn't quite right and they put Michael Nisa into the squad for the final and Josh won't be playing. So the Hazlewood and Warner are their big issues, 100%. But I say again, no matter what David says about his future, it will be irrelevant to the selection equation in England. He will either, if he is out of form for three or four tests, that will be it. If he's in form, he carries on seamlessly to Australia. And once he's back in Australia, where we all know he tends to score a lot of runs, they won't drop him mid-series. He will either get that series or he won't. He will know at the start of the summer whether he can retire in Sydney. It's interesting. Steve Waugh, remember, did a last lap against India. He got there. But it was pretty tense times, though, I have to say.
So if Warner didn't make the end of this Ashes series, would that be it? Could you see him? Because as you rightly point out, he makes runs for fun in Australia.
Yes, that would be it. That would be it. Look, he's in his mid-30s. He's had a great run. For mine, he's one of the most underrated players in Australian cricket history, because just what he did, you know, to start off playing white ball cricket, 20-over cricket, and expand his game from there was extraordinary. Greg Chappell and very few others saw it in him. You know, when he was slogging in the nets in Zimbabwe, Greg said to him, "David, if you're going to, you can be a five-day player, but bat sensibly in the nets, please. You know, you can do it. You can go the long journey." So he got there, and Warner himself said, "I don't think there'll be another me." And it sounded like a statement dripping in hubris, but it wasn't. I sort of get what he was saying, because he's been incredibly adaptable. Now, they're giving him every chance, but that chance is not forever, Jared. They want these Ashes. They know it's the defining series for a group of players who have grown from boys to men together. Hazlewood, Stark, Cummins, Lyon. They've been together for 10 years. They haven't had that golden stud at the end of their career. This is their 2 months. No individual prize will be prioritised ahead of group glory on this trip. And that's just a fact.
The Hazlewood conundrum. So I suspect there's an element here of Josh being comfortable in his own body, because these are not recent issues, are they? They stretch across a couple of years. Is Andrew McDonald, when he was in the studio, if you read between the lines, he just wasn't going to be ready for the World Test Championship, and they were hoping that he would be ready for the first test. So it's on a knife's edge, clearly, when he will feel ready to bowl at his optimum day in, day out.
And it's terribly tricky, Jared, because there's no warm-up games per se. It's such a compressed tour with 6 tests in about 7.5-8 weeks. That how will they know when he's ready? I mean, bowling in the nets is fine, but that's one of the reasons Australia had such success in the 90s and the 2000s in England was because they had a long list of county games to sort out all their issues. Now there's none. So, and even to the fact that Scott Boland's going straight into the team, apparently, for the World Test Championship, which means they'll have 4 bowlers having a cold start. You know, Michael Nisa, who's been running hot in English county cricket for Glamorgan with bat and ball. Gee, I would have been tempted to play him, Jared.
Yeah.
Not as the first choice, that's Cummins. And maybe not even as the second choice, but certainly the third choice. You know, I just think, you know, he's when all bowlers are coming from a standing start into a World Test final and you're ignoring the guy whose engine's been rumbling for 2 months. Big call, big call.
What a glorious mystery this one-off test match is as a grand final. Is The Indian players are largely out of the IPL. Australian players are coming from all sorts of different setups. There's no preamble to it. They're on neutral territory. I couldn't be more – what sort of pitch will it be? I couldn't be more fascinated with how this is going to look on Wednesday night.
Yeah, no, I'm the same, Jared. There is so much mystery to it. Like, one thing I will say, though, not to be underestimated, are India's swing bowlers. Mohammad Shami bowls a beautiful outswinger. Siraj is very good. And if I was them, I would actually drop Ashwin and play a fourth seamer and let Ravi Jadeja do the spin bowling. So anything could happen. I mean, there's a feeling that, oh, India won't be India when they get to England. But the days of India being spin-centric are gone. You know, they've got beautiful swing bowlers. And I remember about 3 years ago when Mohammad Shami was bowling in England, someone said he's more of an English seamer than the English seamers. Yeah. So beautiful swing bowler.
Yes. Do you have a gut feel? Which way would you lean if I nailed your foot to the floor?
I just think I quite like – I reckon this generation of Australian players have been building up this game, secretly prioritising it for a couple of years in a way that I'm not sure whether the Indians are. And that can work for you or against you, but I just think we'll know early. I've just got this feeling one team will turn up and the other won't.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can be like that when they're both coming into foreign conditions. It's a hard one to read. I do like what this test is doing for cricket. I really do. And I know my old mate Gideon Haig said it's sort of basically cricket playing lip service to a dying form of the game. And he's right, because away from this, there's no attempt anywhere to reconstruct the glory of test cricket. But I don't know. I think it can be quite special, this little event, because Jared, we've spent so much time talking about who's in the final and who's going to get there the last 2 years, and I think that will grow in stature over the next 2 years as well.
You tipped your hand a couple of weeks ago, and it occurred to you that Australia is going to win the Ashes. Did you watch the Baz Ballers on Friday night?
Oh, I know. They completely decimated the poor old Irish team. Like, what was the score? 540 or something like that. But, hey, guess what? I saw something overnight that absolutely convinced me Australia will win the Ashes, and that is the stunning news that their spinner, Jack Leach, has been ruled out of the series. Now, I know a lot of people listening to us that say, oh, yeah, Jack Leach, he's just okay, the left-arm spinner, he just whacks away. But guess what? He's the only spinner in England to take more than 10 first-class wickets this season. There is no one behind him. There is, you know, we think we're struggling before Todd Murphy with Nathan Lyon back up, they are worse. Their frontline spinner could be Joe Root for the Ashes. So that's and you know what? They're competing against the very underestimated Nathan Lyon, who last time in England took 20 wickets at 31. Rock solid performance. Not the star, but the supplementary cement that every winning challenge needs, you know. So I just, when I saw that overnight, it just convinced me that that Australia will win this series, Jared.
I wonder what it does to the thinking around pitches. So England had expressed its desire for flat, barren pitches that were batting paradises. You need a decent spinner in those circumstances, don't you?
It's a very good point. With Stokes saying we want our pitches flat and fast, and then Mitchell Stark came back with, oh, really? I've never played on a fast wicket in India, in England? Good point. Very true. But that's it. They need seaming decks now, because without any spinner and the prospect that Lyon will graft and graft away, they want, you know, maybe Joe Root is their number one spinner. Maybe they choose a Will Jacks or someone like that, an all-rounder, which to me never works. When the England choose these spinning all-rounders, they're never good enough as spinners. So I'd go with Joe Root for 10 overs a day and play an extra seamer who also comes into play because Ben Stokes has a knee injury and is struggling to bowl. I think they've just about got to go that way. But it's caught everyone by surprise, this lower back injury to Jack Leach that no one saw coming. They had not prepared at all for someone to back up to him. And can you believe, out of all these counties in England, Jared, there's no backup spinner? Like, goodness me, what are you doing with your academies?
Yes, it's It's wretchedly unfortunate timing for them. So Archer, we well knew, wasn't going to make any meaningful impact. So that was a bit disappointing from a spectacle. But to lose your spinner to stress fractures, it was just all wrong when it came through.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he sort of had embraced the whole baseball culture in a different sort of way. Like, okay, he's a containing sort of bowler, but McCullum had said to him, mate, why don't you try taking wickets and bowling to an attacking field? Let's have a go at it. And he did have a go at it, and he went okay. So he had performed his own little role in the legend of baseball over the last year, and that's why if they bring a new player in, they will get monstered by Australia. Then we'll see baseball deluxe, because Australia will just decide, right, just as they did in Brisbane to Jack Leach during the last Ashes. They said, okay, champion, you're going to go for a few today. Yeah. And they didn't, and it really rocked his confidence.
I'm you're my guide, Crash, right? But when I watch the way that they bat, it almost makes every other consideration redundant. I was calling the footy on Friday night, could barely take my eyes off the screen. And Ireland had been so competitive with England the last time they played at Lord's when they were playing English test cricket. And now they play this phenomenal baseball and go at 6.5 and over. I watch it and go, how did no team prior to this ever decide to play test cricket this way? And I think there's either a surety or an arrogance. This won't work against Australia. I wonder if we're just wishing and hoping and thinking and praying that it won't work against Australia.
Well, all I'll say is this. If it does work against Australia, I'll be the first one to come on your show and dip my lid to the Englishman for completely revitalising the format of Test cricket. I tell you what, Jared, the wounds for me, if Australia loses the Ashes, will not be that deep, because we'll all luxuriate in Test cricket getting the greatest shot in the arm it's had in decades. I mean, the way this team is playing, and just to repeat the stats, before Brendan McCullum took over as coach, I think they'd won one out of their last 17 Tests, and he had two players certain in the team, and they were the vice-captain Joe Root and Ben Stokes, the captain. Every other position was up for grabs. And out of that, they won 11 out of the next 12 Tests, playing this cavalier format. But, you know, it's changed my thinking on sport, Jared. It really has. Because we're seeing Collingwood undo their top button and play this attacking sort of game, and kids really enjoy it. I'm sure somewhere in the show we'll mention Ange Postecoglou, likely to go to Tottenham Hotspur, playing this attacking forward press. Players love it. It liberates them. And what's the common thread between Postecoglou, Collingwood and the English cricket team is they're all having a pretty darn good time playing the game.
Yeah. Yep, they are. And don't worry that it was against Ireland. They've done it against every team in every condition so far. And we're about to see what it looks like against Australia. It's mesmerising when they bat. I'll tell you the one story I watched Thursday night? Thursday night was night one. I watched Stuart Broad bowl, stayed up far too late. He takes 5 for, and the next morning's paper has the Dave Warner story talking about, well, if Broad is there and gets selected, you know, Broad's going just fine, I think. He's going just fine.
Yeah, he's worked his way up to this nicely. My hand's in the air. 4 years ago, I thought that would be the last we'd see in England of Jimmy Anderson and Broad. But Anderson's back at age four, turns 41 during the series, and Stuart Broad at 36. The great pot stirrer, the great sort of, even in his appeals for some of those wickets, like when he got an LBW that was conspicuous, he took about 4 steps down the wicket and said, I'm not even going to turn around on that one. It's so obvious. Oh, okay, I will turn around. He's such a showman, Stuart Broad. And as we so often say, I hope he joins the SEN commentary team down the track, because you'll have the best half hours of your life with him sitting beside you, stirring the pot, you know, just sort of putting little fires and acorns on people's seat.
30-year anniversary of the Warne ball was written about with such fondness across the weekend. You were there for it, Crash?
Do I have to admit this? I was there, but I wasn't there.
Right.
I was there, but we were on strike. So our papers had gone on strike. So I was lying in my bed at the Copthorne Hotel watching it on television. And so I wasn't allowed to write about it for 24 hours. So I was absolutely devastated by that. And only missed the greatest moment of the century, Jared, because they said, you do not turn up to this ground. We are on strike. Could you leave the ground immediately, please? So I'm lying in my bed watching it. But my memory from it is a couple of things, that he just took cricket where it's never been before, into that blind spot, into the batsman's, drifting the ball into the blind spot in the batsman's leg stump, where no coaching manual ever goes. No coaching manual ever says, now, when the ball drifts this way from a leg spinner. So it was a freakish bit of work. The second thing was, for the rest of that series, Jared, there was dozens of kids bowling leg spin during lunch breaks in county grounds. They'd swarm the ground. It was the most beautiful thing. And the third thing was talking to Shane Warne's mentor, Terry Jenner, for the definitive quote when he said, this ball will make 1,000 kids take up leg spin, but hey, I'm tipping that none will get through to the elite level of test cricket because it's so hard. He said, there'll be thousands at junior level and underage level, and there they were in under 15 state teams. You'd see photos of leg spinners with earrings and blonde hair and one Australian carnival. There was six of them, one from each state. They all had the earrings and blonde hair. None of them made it. It's that hard. Leg spin is so hard.
Oh, I'm going to carry that with me for the rest of the day, Crashes. 30 years ago, you were there, but you weren't there. Wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock on a Monday. Our NBA updates this morning for Tyre Power end of financial year sale now on. Game 2 of the finals, Denver 61, Miami 59. So this is a thriller in the early minutes of the third quarter. More with Crash coming up. Melbourne's weather, shower to a top of 19 for City Power, inspecting and maintaining the CBD underground electrical network.
So they're going to finish it here. A lovely ball by Abada. Shot! The treble yell from the Celtic supporters. History. History, boys. Celtic 3, Cali Thistle 1. The 22-23 Scott Cup winners,
let's enjoy this. You know, I deserve to enjoy this. People around me deserve to enjoy this. Whatever other people want to focus on and talk about, I'm not going to miss enjoying this moment with, you know, this group of people, but also I add to my family, my friends, all of those people closest to me. Everyone works hard, makes sacrifices to enjoy these moments. And, you know, I understand that other people who aren't invested in it want to ask these questions, but for me, right now, the most important thing is that we reflect and just be in the moment of creating something special.
Ange Postecoglou held a line in the lead-up to the Saturday final of the Scottish Cup, trying to complete the Scottish treble. So in the lead-up and the aftermath, just to cocoon himself from the speculation that he's going to be the next coach of Tottenham Hotspurs, I think we were watching the Celtic fans think they're going to be the most heartbroken sporting group in the world. He's delivered them so much. They love him dearly. Crash, is it possible that we were more concentrated on the Scottish treble than we were the A-League grand final on our own shores?
I think it's a fair question. And for a lot of people, it is. And if he goes to Tottenham Hotspur, and at age 57, I think he's just about have to. Jared, wouldn't he? Like, you know, they're a good club. It's what he's always wanted. They've got upside. Sure, it's volatile. They've had, you know, three managers this year. But, you know, how does he turn his back on it? And the thing is, he can always come back to Scotland, can't he? I mean, he's leaving on the most pristine terms that anyone could ever imagine. You'd hate to be coaching Celtic after him, wouldn't you? Where do you take him, for goodness sakes? But when you leave on such good terms, you can always return. But, you know, you won't always get offers. Just say they went south next year. Well, the EPL offers may dry up. So he will coach as he coaches, you know, from the Brisbane Roar to Japan to Scotland. He's just had this same style of aggression, forward press, attacking. And it's just wonderful to see, isn't it, really?
It's brilliant to see. And I think we all want to see him get to the EPL in the right circumstances. I don't know. There's a few who are Jacob in Brunswick could text this through, Crash. Being a 54-year-old Spurs supporting lifelong Ange fan, this is deeply disconcerting. I should be ecstatic, but I'm stuck in this existential terror. What if Spurs does the Spurs thing to Ange? What if it all goes wrong? If any club can knock the gloss off Ange, it's Tottenham. Yep. But, can you imagine if the Postecoglou brand is stronger than the Spurs brand? I really can't cope.
God, is there anything? Aren't you missing out unless you've got a mate who's an EPL fan, dyed in the wool? I always sense that. If you haven't got an old-fashioned English mate who's invested in a club like that, you just haven't lived as a sports fan. But it's a good point, isn't it? I think their history works for him and against him. Sure, you know, they'll chew him up and spit him out if he doesn't get results, and results will be much harder to get than in Scotland when there's really only two dominant teams. If it's not Celtic, it's Rangers, and they've dominated since the mid-1980s. However, I think they are, if he does last a couple of years, you know, and goes well, you've just got to throw your hat in the ring and have a go. And he's ready, isn't he? At age 57, how many chances do you get? I love his humility, Jared. And it was funny, just as you were playing that tape of him after the weekend's victory, it took me back. I remember when he coached the Brisbane Roar to victory, and they sent me along to do a story on the final. And I met him at his last press conference, and I said, I don't know that I've met you, Ange. Robert's my name, and I'm officially the last person on the bandwagon coming in just before the final. And he said, hey, mate, guess what? There's plenty of room on our bandwagon. We welcome everyone. We're so happy to get increased support. It was a statement that stayed with me, because plenty of others would have said, hey, mate, where have you been all season? Yeah. There was none of that. No smart-ass remarks or you know, sort of crooked grins or anything like that. He just said, hey, mate, we welcome anyone. And that was his mantra a decade ago. And I still see the same guy or hear the same guy in that interview.
All right, last one, Crash. I love it when you've been fixating on golf. Sometimes it's the flowing stream where a ball sits on 18. Sometimes it's a Twitter spat. That's what's got your attention?
Well, I'm loving this Twitter spat between Phil Mickelson and Brandel Chamblee, the golf commentator, who doesn't like Liv, and Phil absolutely hates Brandel. And they've been going at it hysterically for a week with Brandel accusing Phil of sidling up with a murderous regime, you know, the Liv, the Saudi connections there, and the death of a journalist who was abducted at an embassy. And Phil coming back with, you know, all sorts of criticism of Brandel and people he associates with and whatever. So they've challenged each other to a debate, but they've barred each other on Twitter. So they're having trouble communicating. Oh, it's just, look, Twitter is a bit of a sewer at times, but there is times it does make you laugh. And listening to these two old boys go hard at it is something. And I must say, Jared, I've enjoyed that, but it's just, I'm more worried about Phil Mickelson because I just think Phil has crossed the Rubicon to a point where this whole thing is getting to him, and he might be worth $1 billion. And they say he's closing in on that amount, but I tell you what, he's losing the plot on social media. And as much as I'm enjoying it, I reckon it's not good for Phil.
Okay. Good on you, Crash. Late nights ahead for us. What's my cutoff for texting you? Is it about 1 a.m., 1:30? What's fair? What's the last text?
You can go to 1:30, but you can expect a reply about 7 a.m.
Yes, okay. Very
I do
good.
My best. Do you know that the great challenge, Jared, is lunch? You power yes. your way through to 10 o'clock and you think, wow, that was good. 10:05, you're still, you know, thinking about it all. 10:10, the eyelids are getting heavy. And 10:20, good night.
Good night, Crash.
Thanks, Jared. See ya.
Wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock on a Monday.